Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duverdi are your hosts. Every week right here at AM 1290, FM 96.9, and streaming at AM 1290, KZSB.com. We're repeated at 11 and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets and in Montecito's Upper Village. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. Welcome back stateside.
Well, I may break into my, I just came back from France, as you know, and I may break into my French. It's tough to,
I have to say, I'd love to hear the French New York accent come out. I feel like that would be sheer comedy.
Yeah, that's not going to happen because I only have one word I know in French.
I'm not sure it's suitable for on air. So let's introduce our guest. We have with us again, returning, Dr. Peter Rupert, who is a professor of economics at UCSB, as well as the executive director for the Economic Forecast Project, which if you haven't been to, it's definitely eye-opening and wonderful to learn more about the economy of our local economy, as well as the state. So, Peter, thanks so much for being here with us.
Diane, thank you very much. Thank you for having me, Neil.
So I think that's not a good enough introduction, Diane. Peter has not only been a former guest, but he has the record of being the most frequent guest we've had and also probably the best guest we've had. So thank you so much for being here and for all of your wisdom. And speaking of wisdom, the first article today I have is interesting because, and this is the first time I've done this, I have three articles that came out in the last 2 days on exactly the same subject. Three articles, three different newspapers. And it's about Daniel Kahneman, who is someone that if you got an email recently from Diane, his quote is on the bottom of every one of her emails. And Daniel Kahneman is an economics professor who won the Nobel Prize in Economics and is considered to be the founding father of behavioral economics. Traditional economics, the first article begins, assumes that human beings generally act in fully rational ways, that any exceptions tend to disappear as the stakes are raised. The behavioral school is based on exposing hardwired mental biases that can warp judgment, often with counterintuitive results. The most important of these the behaviorists hold is loss aversion. Why, for example, does the loss of $100 hurt about twice as much as the gaining of $100 brings pleasure? Loss aversion theory also suggests it's foolish to check one's stock portfolio frequently, since the predominance of pain experienced in the stock market will most likely lead to excessive and possible self-defeating caution. I'll skip to the second article for a second because what it says in the second article is that the stocks that people sell outperform the ones that they buy. And as he joked, the cost of having an idea is 4%. That is, if you make a decision, it's probably going to be the wrong one. Anyway, getting back to the first article, which I think is, I'm very impressed with this. Nicholas Taleb, who wrote Black Swan, one of my favorite books. And I thought Nicholas Taleb hated everybody. But in this obituary in the Wall Street Journal, he said he's probably one of the smartest people around. And if he says, if he gives that kind of compliment, I think we need to take note. Now, in the most famous book by Professor Kahneman was the fast and intuitive, the whole notion of fast and intuitive. That is, there are two thinking systems at play. One is fast and one is intuitive. And people tend to look at the fast one and think about, you know, their prejudices, their gut feeling. And he says that doesn't really work. Need to understand that our awareness is not exactly as foolproof as we think. He said that finding that people are overconfident in conjunction with optimism is an extremely common bias, which leads people to think that they are going to always succeed when in fact they don't take into account some of the risks. Anyway, going on, I could, but then an article came out this morning, which I think is so interesting because it's something I didn't know. I read his book, and I, you know, what I just reviewed is something that you can find in his book. But this new article that came out in the New York Times this morning went a step further. It said he also was a proponent of what he called angry science. And what that is in English is he felt that people tend to fight with people who disagree with them and to hang out with people that agree with them. And he said it's important to break this angry science phenomenon. And it was based upon an experience he had. He came up with a study 25 years ago that said that there is a marginal utility of happiness. As you increase your income, you increase your happiness up to about $100,000. When you get past that, there's a decline in the increase in your happiness level. A couple of years later, a Princeton economist named Angus Deaton, also a Nobel Prize winner, came out with a study that said just the opposite. And they had kind of an intellectual fight. And Deaton probably apparently went ballistic. He just trashed Kahneman. And what Kahneman did, which is so different from what people do today in politics, he said, wait a minute. He called him and said, why are we fighting? Let's put our heads together and see if we can figure out who's right and who's wrong. And what they did is they came up to a new study and they found out they were both right and they were both wrong. And that is, there is a decline in the marginal utility of happiness, but it doesn't take place at 100,000. It takes place at 20,000 or 25,000 more. And so the reason this article is important is because it shows that in our politically divisive country, it would be really helpful, not just in economics, but in terms of politics, for us to talk to the people who don't agree with us, as opposed to screaming and yelling at them.
Absolutely. And I think the important part is that Dr. Kahneman passed away this past weekend, which is why we are talking about him and why these articles have been written in his obituary. And if you were fortunate enough to go to the Westmont breakfast a few years back, right after, I want to say, I can't remember the year with COVID, I have no sense of time, but he gave a great presentation at the Westmont breakfast. Mm-hmm. Peter, were you there at that one?
No, I was not. I wasn't able to make it.
So the next article is a little bit less exciting. It's about problems people are having with CDs. And the article exposes a problem that many banks have created where if you buy a CD, which people started doing, about half of new savings money in the last year has gone into CDs where you lock in an interest rate for somewhere 9 months, a year. Well, what some banks are doing is they are not very clearly disclosing the fact that if you don't ask for your money back, it rolls over into a new CD at the current interest rate. So a bunch of banks have collected money over the last year as high as 5% interest and are rolling them over into 0.0002%. Not only that, but once it rolls, you can't get out unless you pay a penalty fee. So there's this uproar about how do banks get away with this? And the way they get away with it is all they have to do is notify you that the CD is going to roll. But most of people who aren't sophisticated think they're just going to roll over into the same interest rate. So there's a real problem here with, you know, people lack understanding. So if you have a CD, make sure that when it comes due that you either get your money or insist upon a higher interest rate. The next article is from the Intelligent Investor in the Wall Street Journal. It's called Betting on a Big Bitcoin Bet. And what I think this is really interesting is there's a guy, and I think, you know, people have read about this guy for the last year, who is the executive chairman of MicroStrategy. Now, you would think MicroStrategy is a software company, which it was, But what he decided to do is rather than to invest in his company, he bought Bitcoin and he wants to buy all the Bitcoin in the world. And what's really, and this is typical of what, of the, you know, the DJT, which is the Donald Trump insanity that's going on with his company that went from 71 2 days ago to 47 today on a total sales of $3 million and a loss of $58 million. But here you've got a company that is selling at twice the value of the underlying assets in Bitcoin. And the reason he can do this is because most times when you offer new stock, it's dilutive, meaning that you actually reduce the earnings per share. But because his price of his stock price is so high, every time he issues stock, he increases the value of his company. And so it's like a money machine for him. He just keeps issuing both stock and debt, buying Bitcoin. And because it's anti-dilutive, it increases earnings even more. So I'm not going to predict, not on the radio at least, but I would consider this to be something that is nothing but trouble down in the future. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 and 96.9, and we'll be right back.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
When I think of the soul of a child who has died, I picture a butterfly so beautiful and brave, I ask myself, is this a child I could have saved?
I'm Lynn Bozoff, president of the National Meningitis Association. For me and so many other parents, the butterfly symbolizes children we lost to meningitis. Their deaths could have been prevented through vaccination. Bacterial meningitis is a devastating disease that within hours can kill an otherwise healthy child or cause long-term complications like deafness, brain, kidney damage, or limb loss. Make sure your child is protected. Visit our website at nmaus.org to learn about the two vaccines that protect preteens and teens. Visit nmaus.org. Vaccination is the right thing to do.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
Peter, and we can be reached at moneytalk1290@gmail.com, or you could give us a call at 805-692-5102.
Peter, we didn't give you a chance to comment on Kalman, however you pronounce his name. By the way, he admitted that he was not the founder of behavioral science. He just kind of picked up on it. But can you explain what your view of all of this is?
Yeah, no, he's a fascinating person. I actually used one of his papers, some results of one of his papers in a paper I have on basically on why people don't take jobs that are far away from them. And it was because they hate commuting. And anyway, so he had a paper where they interviewed people, they surveyed, and they asked sort of like, what are your favorite things? What are your least favorite things? And I think there was 15 he put up there. The last one was morning commute. That was the thing people hated the most. And what they liked the most was kind of socializing and socializing at work. And by the way, sex was like number 7 or 8 or 9 or something. It wasn't as high up as I had thought people would say. But
what do you mean? You mean sex at work or sex at home?
Yeah, you should have broke that down. But you know, I feel that the behavioral economists, you know, I really like to say that, you know, economics itself is a behavioral science, and you know, they use a term that means something a little bit different. But this thing about optimism, so one of my former students has a really nice paper now on trying to understand a little bit more why men and women get paid differently. And it turns out they do these surveys. It comes from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It's called Expectations Survey. And what they did was they asked people, when they're unemployed, how long do you think it'll be before you take a new job? And what's the wage you think you will get at the new job? Well, it turns out men are overly optimistic. They believe they're going to get a draw from a really good wage distribution. And so what they keep doing is they wait, because they think that they're going to get a higher wage. And if they get a low wage offer, they don't take it. But they're wrong. Okay. So it turns out in the data, they're wrong. But what they've done is, because they're waiting longer, they're unemployed longer, but they get a higher wage. Women are spot on in terms of their expectations. And so they take the job at a bit of a lower wage, which is the right job that they should be taking. And so she can explain like 15 or 20% of the male-female wage gap, because men are, I'm not going to say stupid, I'm going to say, you know, they're overly optimistic in the labor market.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's just amazing.
So, you know, given that, well, I feel like I should tell everyone the quote that I have on my email, because I don't email with everybody, but my quote, that my takeaway from Dr. and I think it's Kahneman.
Kahneman, yeah.
His quote was, when investing, people think in terms of gains and losses. Investing for wealth is not about gains and losses. It's about the broad framework that is needed when thinking about wealth. And I just had to, I loved that quote, and I've had it on there since he came to speak in Santa Barbara, because it's so true. The day-to-day ups and downs or gyrations of the market have very little to do with the wealth accumulation. And I think that that's sometimes where people really get lost, is they're very concerned about the day-to-day and they lose track of the overall big picture. Would you agree with that, Peter?
I do agree with it. I mean, you know, look, people buy lottery tickets. I mean, people buy Bitcoin, right? I mean, you know, these are just speculative gambles, you know, with possibly, you know, big payoffs with a very low probability, you know, and so.
So Peter, you know, if you look at a lot of the economics programs across the country, certainly before the last crisis, it was very, very loaded with mathematics and econometrics. And one of the things that I didn't mention in the article is that he said this is not about mathematics. And I wonder if, you know, the teaching of economy, of the kind of high-level mathematical models used by not only academics but economists can sometimes lead to myopia. You know, they got these computer programs when maybe you need more common sense.
I agree. No, I agree. And so I don't think you can do one or the other. I think you have to do both. I mean, you know, you just can't go around looking at some data and see, you find some correlations. If you don't kind of understand the underlying model somehow, now it doesn't have to be highly mathematical, but you really should understand, again, the behavior, you know, of what's going to happen. So for example, you know, if the Fed raises the Fed funds rate, we kind of have a sense of what it's going to do, you know. To go farther, you know, we've written down models. I mean, go back to Keynes and our Nobel Prize winner, Finn Kidlin, kind of understanding all that stuff, you know. And so I think without a model, you just have a hard time explaining correlations. I mean, because at the end of the day, they're just correlations. So we really want to know what's driving those particular things.
And so to that end, you know, what is your macro view of the economy right now? What trends are you seeing and what correlations are you seeing with what's going on in the economy?
I mean, I've been saying for the last couple of years, the economy is as strong as it's ever been. I mean, the unemployment rate is low. There's tons of jobs available. Wages are rising at a decent rate. Inflation's finally come down a little bit, though it's back up. We can talk a little bit more about what that'll imply for the Fed. And, you know, kind of anything you look at, you know, the economy's just doing gangbusters. And so, you know, I've been saying that for a long time. The most recent trend, you know, that's looking worrisome is the inflation trend. And I know we just have a couple minutes before the break, but, you know, we can talk about that a little bit more after the break and sort of what we want to measure. And is there a theory behind what we want to measure to understand what the Fed's going to do and what that'll imply?
So that's what I've also been seeing in the data. However, when you look at it, you say, you know, you still have these people who are trying to ring the bell that, you know, a recession is coming because the deficit, because of this, that, the other thing, you name it. You know, there are always big, scary things out there, but there isn't always a recession. And the data that you're speaking of is the same data that points to the fact that there isn't going to be a recession in the short term. So how do these other economists actually, you know, put together that correlation?
Well, here's an example. You know, tomorrow morning, Neil will come out and say, I believe that there will be a recession starting, you know, 27 days from now. And if a recession happens 27 days from now, Neil's going to be more of a genius than he already is. He's going to write a book about how he figured out all this stuff, make millions of dollars, be on speaking tours. He's the guy that called it recession. So every day there's some economist out there saying that we're going to be in a recession soon. One day they're going to be right, you know. So, but there's really nothing in the data that's really pointing to that at the moment.
You know what Paul Krugman said? He said that, and this is his own prejudice. He said Republican economists never admit they're wrong; Democratic economists do. And people who say recession will be in 28 days never speak up at 29 days and saying, "Oops, I made a mistake." And one of the reasons I like Paul Krugman is he's always willing to say, I blew it.
Yep, agreed.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 and FM 96.9, and we'll be right back.
Our family has been here in over 30 years. We've always been in the hospitality business. So when we're looking for a bank to finance our deal, American Riviera actually stepped up for us. They know Santa Barbara well. Right now, we don't have any plan to open another hotel, but if we do in the future, we'll be talking to American Riviera Bank for sure.
You can bank on American Riviera.
We do.
American Riviera Bank, bank on better.
The organization known as Safe Launch works to prevent adolescent exposure to alcohol and other drugs. Here's Safe Launch co-founder and executive director, Janet Rouse.
We are focused on primary prevention, universal primary prevention for all youth. We promote the One Choice initiative, which is an initiative that says no use of substances by anyone under 21. Brains are so much more susceptible, developing brains are so much more susceptible to damage and addiction and dependency if they are exposed at a young age to any drug. We have a website, safelaunch.org. The email is info@safelaunch.org. And the phone number is 805-283-7233.
To learn more about Safe Launch, go to safelaunch.org. Call 805-283-7233, or the email address is info@safelaunch.org.
Hello, I'm Diane Duva.
And I'm Neil Kreisel.
And we're inviting you to join us Mondays at 2 p.m. right here for Money Talk,
the radio program that talks about finance, financial planning, and wealth management strategies.
So please join us Mondays at 2 and 11 p.m., Tuesdays at 4 a.m., and Saturdays at 6 p.m. for Money Talk right here at KZSB.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
And we can be reached at 805-692-5102, or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. So we had a listener just send in an email that a question for Dr. Rupert, which is, given that the owner equivalent rent accounts for a large amount of the CPI/PCE, do you think that it is an efficient method of calculating housing inflation, generally speaking?
Okay. I mean, so again, so the CPI, the consumer price index, you know, that comprises a basket of goods that consumers spend money on. The PCE is the personal consumption expenditures, which is pretty much all of consumption, just not this market basket that's in urban communities like the CPI is. So they're two different measures. Owner equivalent rent, you know, it's hard to think about another way to really try to get an understanding of, you know, of what this means. Now, so why do I say that? So imagine right now, you know, you are renting a house for, you know, $3,000 a month. So your expenditure on rent is $3,000 a month. And so that goes into your expenditures in consumption, and it's in your market basket of goods. Got it. Suppose that your parents give you a lot of money and you buy the house. Okay. And you have no mortgage. They just give you the money. Now you've got this house. Well, you're not spending any money on rent, but you're getting a flow of services from this house. And the flow of services you're getting from this house, that's what rent is. You're willing to pay $3,000 a month to have a roof over your head in a certain location, et cetera. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that if someone buys a house instead of rents, that the measure doesn't change. And that's why the Bureau of Economic Analysis takes every house in the U.S. that's owned and turns it into what looks like equivalent rent. Okay. Mm-hmm. So how do they do that? They just say, they look at sales of houses that are similar in the area. They kind of understand, you know, what that price is. They look at houses that rent in that area and look at those rents. And then they implicitly apply that measure to the purchased house. Okay. So that's kind of the way, you know, that stuff works. And again, the reason you do that is you don't want, if you go from renting to owning, you know, how much you're spending on housing per month shouldn't change. I mean, it shouldn't go to zero if you don't have a mortgage, because you're actually paying something for this house. Okay, so that's the measure. Is it overinflated? I don't think so. I mean, you know, it kind of depends where we are, obviously. So, you know, is it a good measure? Is it a perfect measure? Probably not. Probably not. We'd like to have an identical house, right? That's rented, and an identical house that's owned. We don't have those. We have close substitutes. So not a perfect measure, but, you know, again, the level may not be so interesting. It's the rate of change. So, and I think there it's a little better.
And so do you think it's an appropriate measure for Santa Barbara as well, just given that's, you know, everybody in Santa Barbara, we all say our real estate market is unique relative to the rest of the country. It is, I don't know if it's unique in that regard. It just might be more expensive, right?
Yeah, I agree. No, you know, I hear this all the time that Santa Barbara is unique. It's not unique. Santa Barbara faces the same economic forces as everybody else. We're only different in the sense that, you know, we can't expand very much. You know, the supply is just a little bit limited compared to someplace like Phoenix, Arizona, or, you know, Austin, Texas, where you can keep building out. Here, we're kind of constrained. So, you know, that's going to matter. But then what you want to do is look at other places like that. Would you say San Francisco is unique? I would have said it was unique until we've recently seen house prices fall 30 or 40%, right, in San Francisco because of what's happening. Santa Barbara housing prices in the Great Recession, you know, they fell. They weren't immune to market forces. So, you know, maybe we're a little more, you know, immune in the sense that they can't go down too far because we're just so limited in our space in the supply of housing.
You know, one thing though is missing from this calculation, and that is the risk premium for owning and the value of appreciation where you don't get rent. And so, you know, it's not equivalent to be in a rental situation versus an ownership situation, because one of the things you get as an owner is the possibility of appreciation. And while you could say, well, that's offset by a loss, for 100 years, it's only gone up. So one could say that there should be some adjustment on a risk premium basis that is being rewarded by owning rather than renting. Yeah. That's my
unless you were in Santa Barbara this last weekend with the hail and mud.
No, that's a good point, Neil. I think that is a good point. You know, we really don't take account of that risk factor. But I can tell you that, you know, housing is actually on average not that different than other real assets in the sense that the rate of return on housing, you know, has always been somewhere between 5% and 8% on average per year. Just like the stock market on average and other things. And, you know, it's simply because, you know, if we're getting 15% returns every year on housing, people like, hey, I want to get that return and, you know, flip the house and do whatever, you know, it increases the price of the house as more people demand that house, right? So the rate of return on housing, you know, is not 15 or 20%. It's just, you know, it's more like it, like I said, in sort of a standard real asset that you would own that would, you know, pay back something.
Exactly. And I'd say the only upside as opposed to the stock market would be that you're usually doing your home with leverage. So you're able to take advantage of that, you know, 5%-ish return, but you're not having to put out the whole dollar amount because most people do have a mortgage and share that Correct. Risk with the bank.
Correct. Yeah, but the other advantage also is versus stock, you can't live in a stock certificate. You can live in a Correct. House. So there's a utility function that's why yep. I like real estate. You get yes, the appreciation, sure. you get the use.
Yep.
Yes. However, you know, if you need to borrow from it, if you need the money to eat, oftentimes banks are less likely to lend to you from your home equity if you actually need the money for, you know, daily living.
Right.
Well, I just went to get new glasses at the local Montecito eyeglass store, and they provide mortgages for people to buy their glasses.
Yeah. Well, that's because you need expensive. To get out of your bubble, Neil. Come over to Santa Barbara, the dark side.
No, I can tell you, though, when I was buying my house, I bought it actually in 2007. And the person I had bought it from, he had built the house himself in the 1960s. I think for around 75,000 or 80,000, I can't remember what that number is. He lost his job in 2005, foreclosed on his house. He owed $1.4 million on the house.
Holy smokes, on a $75,000 house?
Yes. I mean, they redid the kitchen for like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars in the backyard. They both had a Mercedes. They were doing they were taking money out of the house. And, you know, and using it as consumption.
And then it came home to roost, unfortunately.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's talk for a minute about, you know, you recently had a mid-year economic forecast project event, and the economic forecast, you know, summit is happening here shortly on May 9th. Tell us a little bit about if people are interested in attending, what the details are.
Sure. You can, you know, come to the Forecast Project. You can, you know, just Google USCSB Economic Forecast Project. And on the About page, you can find, you know, where you can be buying these tickets if you'd like to go. We're always happy to get new sponsors. I know after the break, I can tell you who's going to be there and what we're going to do. Maybe entice people a little bit to attend.
Right. I attend every year, and it's always a fascinating learning. And it's so fun to see you up on stage and making all of these terms and conversations really approachable. So thank you for doing that for our community, Peter.
Oh, my pleasure.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 and FM 96.9, and we'll be right back.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment.
We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
The Storyteller Children's Center provides early childhood education in Santa Barbara County. Here's Dr. Gabriela Garcia.
Storyteller is an early childhood education center focused on the social and emotional development of children, as well as comprehensive family services to help break the cycles of trauma and poverty. Education, a safe place, and care 8 hours a day with two meals and a snack daily, as well as restorative sleep, dental and health screenings, and of course, that mental wellness component that is so important. People can get a hold of us by going on our website, storytellercenter.org. It is a beautiful thing to get to see what we can do when the community comes together to truly make an impact.
To learn more about the Storyteller Children's Center, go to storytellercenter.org or call 805-682-9585.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we can be reached at 805-692-5102, or you could email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. So I think, Peter, I think it's fair to say that you single-handedly were able to change the minds of the Santa Barbara City Council in the issue surrounding rent control. And so I was on the Economic Forecast Project, and I have to say, I love your Harry Truman quote that's there that says, we must have strong minds ready to accept facts as they are. And so I wonder if rent control is going to be one of those things that we're talking about at the Economic Forecast Summit in May.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It could. In the mid-year one we did, which is for, you know, our sponsors, and basically we titled that Saving California. And on it, I had a good friend of mine, Lee Ohanian, who writes articles and, you know, basically talked about, you know, the parts of California that are really, really suffering. You know, there's lots of examples. I don't want to go into them all, of course, but. And this one, we're trying to focus a little narrower. This one's called Saving Santa Barbara. A bit provocative. We're not going to save Santa Barbara at this talk. It's going to be me and Gene Deering, who's at Radius, and, you know, talking about, you know, what's going on the commercial real estate side with multifamily, you know, perhaps some of the multi-use situations that are out there, what's being built, what's not being built. And then I invited Rick Caruso.
Ooh.
So Rick Caruso is going to come. And, you know, he does have an interest. He's got the Miramar, or I guess Rosewood, we call it now. Or do we still call it the Miramar?
I think we still call it the Miramar. Who knows?
Yeah. So, you know, he's got the Miramar. And I don't know if you've been to the Grove recently in L.A., but, you know, he really transformed, you know, a not so nice section of L.A. into like a beautiful thing that I think everybody in Santa Barbara kind of likes. I mean, at least that's what they talk about. And he did Pacific Palisades. So he really understands development and where things are going. And I hope he's going to be, you know, able to, you know, help our city, you know, think about what to do. And, you know, this is a hard one. Like, I got it. You know, it's, you know, we closed the State Street down many years ago. We're still battling what to do with it. Right. I mean, and we're years away, as far as I can tell, we're pretty still far away from deciding what to do with it. I happened to go to the UCSB Art Museum a few years ago, and I was looking through some old things of State Street. And, you know, back in the 50s, they were talking exactly about what we're talking about today. There's pictures, artists' pictures of what State Street would look like if it was closed down, with the fountain in the middle, and little flower, you know what I mean? So
yeah, so the conversation hasn't moved along. I think that makes me think, Peter, of your quote when you were on the show during the pandemic, that the fact that the pandemic forced the city to close it down without having to, you know, figure out what color the trash cans were, right, you know, would see if this would be feasible or not.
Yeah, yeah. And I was asked by some people to do a study on closing down the street. How does it do? You know, what I told them was, I said, listen, you tell me what answer you want. I'll find the street where that happened. Right. It's just mixed, right? You go to some places, Boulder, Colorado does well. Other places don't do well, you know. And so it really depends on just way too many factors. And, you know, the main one for me, and I think I've said it a million times, you know, I want State Street to be a street where you and I and our kids want to go down and walk around and get an ice cream and, you know, have a good meal and shop. And, you know, and I think everybody wants that. You kind of need density.
I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead. I'm done.
So one of the things that's really shocking to me, getting back to rent control, is that there are a few things that have empirical evidence that's so clear. In all places that rent control has been implemented, it made housing worse. It's not 90% or 95%. It's 100%.
It is.
And yet here you've got cities, not just in this area, all over the saying, this is the solution. So, you know, what do you do as a professor that studied for years to get a PhD and you're looking at all and you're wondering about having the right analysis when in front of you people have a fact basis that is irrefutable and still don't listen?
Right. Look, you know, that's kind of the difference between economics and politics, I have to say. I mean, you know, I think there are better solutions, which I've talked about before, having voucher system. It's just very easy. I mean, imagine, you know, I'm running against you, Neil, and you say you're for rent control because you want to help some of the less fortunate people in Santa Barbara, right? And then I say I'm against rent control, and then people are like, oh, he's just on the side of capitalist pig landlords or something. And so they tend to, I would never win an election for that. So it's very easy, by the way, to impose rent control, right? It just takes the city council some number of votes. They don't have to change taxes. They don't have to do any referendums, right? It's very simple to do. And as a politician, you could say to yourself, you see, I'm trying to help. Look what I've done, you know? And it's a simple way to do that. But I can tell you, you know, even the things we have now about, you know, making 10% affordable units, you know, this is not the solution. And I you know, what I like to bring up is there's no section in Vons that says groceries have to be 10% cheaper. Right? I mean, we have figured out how to help people who need food, how to get that food. And it's not by having a section of the store telling Vons they have to charge less for 10% of the products, right? We have a system, we have food stamps, for example, you know, where it comes from other revenue. It doesn't come from, you know, a particular group of people. It comes from, you know, perhaps, you know, tax revenue. So if we really think, you know, this is an issue that our community needs to solve, then the community should solve it. And the way the community could solve it is, look, let's do something like, you know, maybe raise the sales tax 0.5%. That goes into a voucher system where we do it like Section 8 housing a little bit so that people pay the market rent. If they're not paying the market rent, landlords aren't going to build and they're going to, you know, not keep their apartments up, et cetera, unless they get the market rent. That's just human nature, and it's not because they're horrible people. And I think you probably know somewhere between 40% and 50% of properties for rent here are not by large corporations. They're by mom and pops who own one or two small apartments, right? And so they're part of our community too. And back to your risk thing, Neil, they took the risk to buy these places, you know, to rent them out, to make a living. So, you know, I just think that's not the way to solve this particular problem.
So are you going to run for mayor? Is that in the cards?
Yeah, in his spare time, right?
I mean, look, I do think that, you know, council does listen. I think they do. I think, you know, I think our supervisors listen. And the ones that don't listen, guess what happens to them?
They get voted out, right?
They get voted out.
Oh, I was going to say they become Republicans, but I don't want to get into that.
Neil, you need to follow the advice of the article on the top of the hour.
That's true.
Open lines of dialogue, communication.
But you know, there, not to get myself in more trouble, but you know, you talk about the solution being subsidies, and I think that's correct. But then you get this political divide where they say a subsidy is communism or socialism, and so there's this mindset in this country that is bizarre. You know, it's you know, whether it's single payer healthcare or rents, it's, we don't want to. I did it, you know, the lament, I did it on my own, so should that person. Well, first of all, you didn't do it on your own. That's the first thing. That's incorrect. And second of all, you're a human being. Maybe I should run for mayor. Do you think that would?
But look, remember, you know, we don't have this argument about unemployment insurance, do we? We realize that shit happens and someone can, you can become unemployed through no fault of your own, right? And
yeah, but we didn't. Hold on. But when Roosevelt tried to do Social Security, we had these arguments, and now it's accepted. I mean, let's go back. You know, people have always been mean.
Yeah, no, they are. And so, but, you know, we know that, you know, the fact that I might become unemployed for, just like I said, no fault of my own, you know, we want to insure that. You know, maybe we should self-insure. It's not that easy for every individual to self-insure.
We're going to take a break now, and stay tuned for our last segment, because Peter and I are going to give the solutions to all of the world's problems. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 and FM 96.9, and we'll be right back.
American Riviera Bank is actually really good offering the loan to small businesses. The customer service that they give, it was amazing. She actually gave us step by step. She helped me with every single step on the paperwork. She was great. We found a great bank, and now we have a great coffee shop.
You can bank on American Riviera. We do.
American Riviera Bank. Bank on better.
This is you over 30 years ago.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
And this is your mom when you drive her back from therapy.
Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet?
Roles change without us noticing. And in your new role, we help you help. AARP gives you the information to help care for your mom so that you can have patience with her just like she did with you. Visit aarp.org/caregiving or call 1-877-333-5885 to get practical health and wellness tips to provide even better care for your loved one.
Are we there yet?
Remember, visit aarp.org/caregiving. AARP, we help you help. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
In wildland areas, spark arrestors are required on all portable gasoline-powered equipment. This includes tractors, harvesters, chainsaws, weed eaters, and mowers. Keep the exhaust system, spark arrestors, and mower in proper working order and free of carbon buildup. Remember, one less spark is one less wildfire. The California Statewide Fire Prevention Program is grateful for your cooperation. Visit us on Facebook for more information.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
So, Peter, in the last segment, let's talk a little about the Federal Reserve. Initially, the Fed said, or Jerome Powell, the chair, said that he was looking to lower interest rates in 2024, which is this year, three times. The market got very excited about that, and consequently, it's kind of started this market run-up. I venture to even say a bull market run, you know, having us break through new highs. What do you, how is the Fed going to pull this off? Because I really just don't see how, with inflation, you know, under control, but still creeping up, how the Fed is going to be able to lower, not once, not twice, but yet three times in 2024. I think it's, for me, it feels a little
aggressive.
You know, it's one of those things that, you know, typically, you know, what happens when the Fed raises the Fed funds rate that much, inflation does come down and the economy starts to, you know, get worse, right? This time it didn't happen, you know, possibly for lots of reasons. I mean, we're going to debate this for years and years and years as economists, you know, but, you know, and this time, you know, if that happened, then the Fed could say, okay, now the economy is weakening, you know, inflation is not where we want it, but, you know, we're going to adjust the Fed funds rate. Now the problem is the economy is still strong. Inflation is starting to go up. The last 2 months, you know, have brought the trend inflation up, both in the by the way, the Fed looks at the PCE, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. Really fascinating story about it. They used to look at the CPI a long time ago. Then they felt that wasn't the right measure. Then they switched to the personal consumption expenditures. Then they started looking at core because they get rid of food and energy because they're very volatile. Jerome Powell and Krugman now have this thing called Supercore, where they get rid of probably everything we buy, basically.
which I love when you define inflation by everything else except for what consumers buy.
Yeah. So it's now, I think when you get to that heavy super core, it's only about 20% of the products we buy. If you get rid of food and energy, we're still about 75% of the things that we buy. But what they're trying to do is understand underlying price changes. And if you look at the monthly inflation rate, you would never want to respond to the monthly inflation rate. It's just way too volatile. Okay, so, you know, on this thing, this blog I have called Econ Snapshot, you know, we've developed a measure of trend inflation, we call it, that kind of, you know, it's not monthly, it's not year over year, it's kind of something in between. And that number has risen over the last couple of months. And so the Fed is really looking at trend inflation, right? And again, it's the PCE, the PCE X food and energy. That's kind of what they do. Do I think they're going to, if we see another bad inflation result next month, I'm kind of doubting they're going to lower the Fed funds rate three times this year. I just don't see it given this.
Do you actually think that they'll raise it again?
I think that's now going to be in the calculus. I do. I think they're going to, you know, give that some thought. If we see another bad inflation result, for sure, you know, I think that could happen.
But then it begs the question, is that 2% inflation target just incredibly too low? Because wasn't it Janet Yellen that put that in place and it was a come up to inflation number, not a come down to inflation number?
Again, this is debatable. When I worked at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, our president at the time, Jerry Jordan, he said 2% is ridiculously stupid. He said it's immoral that the Federal Reserve, who runs this thing, should tell people $1 today, we guarantee it's only going to be worth 98 cents next year. He said inflation should be zero. Mm-hmm. Zero, not 2%. What kind of target is that? Saying people, we're not going to sit back, you know, stand by the value of our money. He just thought it was crazy.
Well, Peter, we have to stop there. And as usual, we'd love you to come back every week. It was great talking to you. It's also great talking to you too, Diane. And you are all wonderful people to listen to us. Thank you for listening. We'll see you all next week.